Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So, first challenge for Alexa. Alexa, play Yes.
Playing songs by Yes from Spotify.
Alexa, stop. You know what that is, don't you?
I do, yeah. It's not Roundabout, which I thought was what they were going to go for. But there we are.
It's Owner of a Lonely Heart, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Which must have been their biggest hit record, I suppose, if you look at the whole of their career. Your choice.
Go on, let's do one. Slade. Alexa, play Slade.
No, Alexa can't hear you. She can only
hear me.
She only answers to her master's voice. Okay.
Right.
Alexa, play Slade.
Songs by Slade from Spotify.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Come on, feel the noise.
Alexa, stop. Starts with a distinctive call in the room to order sound of... All right, shut up, Alexa. Alexa, you better rest for crying out loud. It's been a long day.
And as Alexa, we may have mentioned before, you and I once went to a lunch where Noddy Holder was presiding. Do you remember?
It was Christmas lunch, more to the point.
It was a Christmas lunch, yeah. And he was the person who called everyone to order and got them to go to the table and told them that the red cabbage was on its way or whatever.
But he wouldn't do Merry Christmas, would he?
Without
a contribution to his...
No, I think there's to be considerable shiny florins tossed in his hat.
I think that there certainly are. Let me try another one. Alexa, if I asked that woman, whose name I won't mention because she'll spark into life, to play a song by Ray Charles, what do you think she'd play, Mark?
Hit the Road, Jack, would it be?
Okay, let's have a go. Alexa, play Ray Charles.
Playing songs by Ray Charles from Spotify.
Yeah!
Thank you.
Alexa, stop.
That's pretty good.
You're absolutely correct. That was very good.
Okay, one more. The Small Faces.
Okay, all right. Alexa, go on. I'm sorry. What were you going to say?
I'm not sure.
Shut up, Alexa. We'll call you when we're ready.
Leave it, Alexa, all right? Walk away. Knock it on the head.
Leave it, darling.
Sling your hook. He's not worth it. Sling your hook, button it.
What were you going to say that she was going to play?
Small Faces, Lazy Sunday, I would have thought. That's the, or Tin Soldier. That's the, all or nothing. Sorry, I can only have one, can I?
Yeah, you can, really. Alexa, play Slade. Not Slade. No, sorry, I already asked you to play that. Alexa, ignore me. Alexa.
Shut up, Alexa. I'm an old duffer. Not fully in control of all my faculties, so have pity on me.
Alexa, play Small Faces.
10 songs by Small Faces from Spotify.
Alexa, stop.
Very good.
Very good work. I'm going to try a real curved ball to see if she recognises anything. Okay. Alexa, play Hap Sash and the Coloured Coat.
I can't find the song. Good.
Thank you, Alexa.
That's
stop.
Probably a good thing.
Because I didn't really want to hear Hap Sash and the Coloured Coat either, but I simply thought I'd try it. So,
talking of Small Faces, we recorded the great Jim Irvin.
Make it sound as if Jim's an actual member of the Small Faces. He's not.
Yeah,
is he?
No, he's not. But it's
one of our award-winning Word in Your Attic video casts. And if you haven't already seen those, please go on YouTube and look up word in your ear, the word in your ear kind of channel on YouTube, and we got a series, haven't we, Mark, of these word in your attic?
We have. Building
a video cast. We did one with Jim Irvin.
He talks about the fantastic P.P. Arnold Small Faces YouTube clip, which I thoroughly recommend to anybody who hasn't seen it, of them doing Tin Soldier. It's fantastic.
It's fantastic. Who else have we done? We've done Sid Griffin. If you haven't caught up with that, Sid playing 8 Miles High on the banjo is a particular musical highlight.
Will McDonald, very fun.
Will McDonald,
very, very good.
We've done one this morning, which isn't out yet, with the great Mark Lewison, the world authority on the Beatles. It tells us about his what it's like living with the Beatles in the way that he's doing. So, listen, I want to talk to you about this this One World.
Did you see it?
I've seen bits of it. You see, because go on.
Well, the thing is, now you don't have to watch it live. Of course, that's the whole thing. There's absolutely no reason to see it as a live event, really. Because A, it's not a live event, and B, these days it doesn't matter. It's easier just to let something sort of go by and then just catch up the next day with what someone's decided the highlights are. But I did see quite a lot of it as it went out, actually, and I don't know what to say, because obviously...
Go on.
I don't want to be uncharitable. I don't want to be uncharitable, because it's fantastic that somebody organised it. Like Lady Gaga, whom I'm a great admirer, was the driving force, I think. And it's great that all these people, you know, stepped up to the mark and played songs. Of course, there's no excuse now, because normally, if you don't want to do something, you can say, well, I'm on tour, or I'm in the studio, I'm doing something, I'm in a different country. Everybody's sitting at home, everybody's underemployed, and everybody's available down the end of a pipe. But and it was great to see, you know, Elton John was out there playing I'm Still Standing on his piano in the garden, and you know, and Paul McCartney did a rather weird version of Lady Madonna from what appeared to be the studio in his place in Sussex, I think. And you know, there was Billie Eilish, who I like very much, doing an old Bobby Hebb song, Sunny. That was great. Taylor Swift was good, with Stevie Wonder. But your problem is, I think, that... Three things, actually. One is that it's all online.
Three things, good.
Three things. Yeah, three things.
One thing, it's all online.
It's all online, and therefore you have that exhausting, kind of rather sapping experience like you do when you do too many Zoom conversations in one day, where it's completely artificial and kind of two-dimensional and very kind of sapping and contained, and it's just one after another people in their living rooms. And secondly, they can't... And also the sound is absolutely frightful. I don't know about you, but when I have actual human conversations now with neighbours walking down the street, I kind of expect them to freeze and their voices to go a bit weird. You get so used to that.
Go metallic halfway through.
Suddenly go metallic. I wouldn't be at all surprised if they did, you know. And, but the second thing is that I don't know, honestly, if I need to be told... Particularly by Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam playing a church organ, that I should be, you know, rooting for my local NHS and medical care personnel. Of course I am. We all are. And it's kind of patronising to have endless rock stars telling us that we ought to be grateful to these people. Of course
I hate
we're
anybody
grateful.
Telling me this, you know, because it implies that without them we wouldn't have thought of it, which is ridiculous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that then before all this, we would have taken for granted anyway. It's not that we're not contributing, Dave. We pay our taxes. You know?
Yes.
I mean, I just... we do actually contribute all the time to the NHS, you know. But somehow we've been made to think that it's been free up till now. And we've all got to put our hands in our pockets. No, but I just found that a bit exhausting. And the third thing, which I think is really interesting, it has implications way beyond just, music broadcasts like this, is there's no audience. And this is affecting everything. That when you see Elton John playing the piano in his garden, you know, he's playing I'm Still Standing, it's great, but there's no reaction. And you realise how much you miss the warmth of the sound of great waves of euphoria and applause that greet people being on stage. And when it just seems incredibly underwhelming to see one after another person in their living room. I think maybe the novelty is wearing off with some of this.
Can I just interject? Because I'm entirely with you on this.
Yeah.
I now found I'm not watching it methodically, but it keeps popping up on my YouTube. Is I keep seeing clips of Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, Larry David. And the whole deal of Larry David in Curb Your Enthusiasm, he says the things that people think but don't say. He actually blurts them out. And yeah. this was a kind of classic case of this, you know. If Elton John were singing and playing the piano in his back garden under normal circumstances, now, admittedly, he'll have a bigger back garden than most of us.
Yeah.
There's going to be one of two responses at the end of it. Either warm applause or shut the fuck up. I'm trying to sleep.
Leave it, Elton. You've woken me up.
Really? We're having a perfectly nice sleep in this deck chair over here, and you suddenly start playing. Yeah. I'm still standing, you know.
This reminds me of my own father when we were watching Live Aid, and my
No, it wasn't Live Aid. It was Diana's.
No, it's Prince Diana. It was the Lady Di's funeral. That's right.
I have to remind you of your memories. Go on.
I know, that's right. I rang him up to see if he was watching. He said, "I was watching him," and suddenly an awful fat man came along and spoiled it for everyone with his singing. And I knew you immediately who he was talking about. Oh, it's just so funny. But anyway, no, you're absolutely right. Those would be your reactions, but they're not now, are they?
You see, the absence of applause, and the most pressing case of this, I do think it's fascinating. You know, there's a lot of talk about when football is going to come back and how football is going to come back. And football is the classic, well, it's like rock and roll. Live football, top-level football, in front of a crowded stadium is the most enthralling entertainment experience on the planet. It is.
Completely. Yeah,
the same players playing the same game in an empty stadium is the least enthralling entertainment prospect on God's earth.
How important the audience is, and B, shouldn't the audience be more appreciated?
You know, I think the audience should be paid.
Fleeced. They're the ones who are having to pay £100 a ticket.
They're paying a fortune. Well, even though the same clubs tell us that make all their money out of telly. Well, therefore, they ought to pay the crowd as if there were extras in a film scene. You know, turn up, give you £10, you watch the game.
But isn't it the same with comedy? We were talking the other day about that guy Michael Spicer, who's fantastic. I'm sure anybody listening will have seen his YouTube clips. He does a thing called The Room Next Door.
He pretends
to be the kind of political advisor talking into the earpiece of the political clown who's on a live interview and telling them
saying all the wrong
it's
things.
It's really, really funny.
It's very good.
Particularly
very good
Boris news. Johnson one was one of the great one about the buses, you know. But, you know, that guy, really hard to compete with that, as a comedian now, because it's the internet that's reacting fastest, isn't it?
Absolutely. I feel sorry for professional comedians at the moment because the internet is just far quicker to the gag. The internet identifies the gag far quicker than an average radio or TV program.
And can deal with it instantly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your Radio 4 program is out of date, you know.
So, but I mean, we're all in favour of, you know, people being supportive of frontline workers and health workers, and God knows we're all absolutely in their debt. No doubt about that at all. But there's a limit to how many pop stars we need to have telling us about it, really.
We ought to mention the Stones. I don't know if you saw the Stones.
Oh, God, yeah. Seen that bit I now. Did.
So
I
the
did
Stones
see
come
the Stones.
On, who I thought were pretty good. Mick Jagger was terrific. I'm sorry. But he was
very
was
good.
He was really good. He really made an effort. And
Can't always get you what you want.
You know, and then they came one more when old Keith sitting on a sofa twiddling away on his acoustic guitar. Ronnie Wood playing one of his rather sort of... uneventful solos. Charlie Watts completely disconnected and apparently playing some boxes on the floor and bits of his sofa with his drumstick. But when you listen to it, you know, it's fairly obvious to me that A, there was a keyboard part, B, there was some proper drums, and C, I think there might have been a bass as well. So there was quite a bit of serious overdubbing going on there, wasn't there? Am I right?
Well, there has to be.
I didn't see this mentioned in any reviews that I read, but I mean, maybe they're just being generous or they didn't notice.
I think there's been a bit of
post-production fiddling going on.
Yeah. You see, what they ought to be doing is getting online and giving really indiscreet interviews. You know, that's what we all want to see. You know, people saying things they've never said before, because as you say, they've got time on their hands. They've got nothing else to do.
You're listening to The Word Podcast. It's not supposed to be professional.
So we got a bit of housekeeping to do, as they always say at company conferences. We got to say thank you to those very kind people who've been to our Patreon page and signed up to contribute towards this massive, multi-fronted, multimedia endeavour. We're very grateful to them, aren't we, Mark?
We are hugely grateful. We're indebted to them, actually, and it's terrific. And we'd like to thank them by name.
And Gavin Hogg challenged us to do the thank yous like this.
Hi there, nice to be with you. Happy you could stick around. Like to introduce Ian Smart on drums.
And Josh Pierce, rhythm pole.
And David Messer, bass guitar.
And Paul Price, the piano.
Come in Alan Knight on the saxophone.
With John Morris on tenor sax.
Hi, Colin Morrison, trumpet.
Say hello to Big Deke 58, xylophone.
And Peter Ellis, guitar.
Scott Hamilton, spoons.
And looking very relaxed, Colin Chalmers on vibes. Nice. Where have we got to? Yeah. Your turn, sir. Samuel Finian on sousaphone. Introducing Dara O'Halloran, clarinet. With David Wright on vocals. Norman Oxlade and his pals, tap dancing. In the Groove with Jamie Commons, violin. Gavin Hogg on harmonica. And over there, Keith Howie, ukulele.
Hi, Keith. But we have to mention that Gary Russell came in as he's our 50th Patreon.
Yes,
isn't he?
Lord. Yes, and representing the flower people, Gary Russell.
So anyway, thank you very much. Thank you very much to thank you very much to all of them. We're hugely grateful. And details of how you can join them are underneath this and the show notes with this particular podcast.
The Word Podcast, one of the few things you really need in life.
Okay, we call this bit Yesterday's Papers because I just thought of it. And basically what we do is Mark and I read old music magazines to ourselves. No, and
that's how we're using our time.
Yeah, I'm going to see if Mark can guess. I'm looking at an issue of Q from 1988, from May 1988. You were. And it's the cover of the Pogues.
It was the only green cover that we did. It has a green square at the top.
There you go. That's the question
left.
I was going to ask you. I was going to ask you what colour was the logo.
Oh, yeah.
Right,
second
magazine publishing trivia question. How much was Q in 1988?
£2.95.
£1.30.
Oh, OK. God, that's a good deal.
Is it?
£1.30.
That's amazing, isn't it, really? That's extraordinary.
Of course, probably could have bought a Morris Minor for £1.30. I can't remember what it was worth, £1.30.
It was less than I was thinking.
You could have bought a 3-bedroom flat in King's Cross.
The Who the Hell, they call him the inventor of rock and roll. And this apparently has given him the right to ride roughshod over all of them for 30 years, extracting hefty wedges from luckless promoters, slighting his fellow musicians, shortchanging his fans and subjecting fair maidens to his oily, unappetizing advances.
I think I wrote that.
I'm sure you did.
Well, it can't be Chuck Berry.
Is it Chuck Berry?
Oh, right. Did we do Chuck Berry? That's amazing.
Tom Hibbert has 3 minutes, but only one question. Who the hell does Chuck Berry think he is? Does he only have 3 minutes? Oh, I think that's a joke about the length of Chuck Berry's songs. I was struck by this. The question near the end, Tom asked him just how long he's going to keep going because he's 61 now.
61.
You remember when the time? They're probably, yeah. Probably members of One Direction who are 61 nowadays, aren't they? When that seemed like really old for a rock star, doesn't anymore, does it?
Absolutely. Tom Hibbert appears in the Craig Brown book about the Beatles, which both you and I have been reading, and he talks about who the hell he does with Cliff Richard, Cliff Richard still rankles about the fact that the Beatles were sort of more popular and have more credibility than he does. And he goes on about, well, I've been going, how long were they? They only went on for 10 years. You know, then they broke up. I'm still going.
Fair point.
I don't know. I thought it was a bit tragic, really.
So it's but also anyway. Got the piece I wrote when I went to New York and I saw Michael Jackson and Bruce Springsteen the same week.
Oh, yeah.
Tunnel of Love Store and the Bad Tour. And that was when I went back to the hotel. What's it called? The French name. I can't remember. I got in the lift and there was Bubbles and his minder.
You're
staying
kidding.
At the hotel. Bubbles.
No, what? Jack, Bubbles had his own. He had a suite of rooms.
Presumably.
That is unbelievable. Was Bubbles calling room service, you think?
Asking for notes.
Was he sitting up there, sort of, you know, flooring cans of Heineken and necking Pringles? He probably was.
So, those are mine. That's what I just picked at random from this huge bound volume of old issues of Q. What have you got?
Well, I got a copy of Disc and Music Echo from February the 7th, 1971, which is absolutely riveting. It's kind of, you know, main kind of constituency is kind of people like the Supremes and Stevie Wonder and Mama Cass. But by page 12, you've got a column called Progressive Sounds and People. And it tells you that Keith Hartley's just formed a new group. Yeah, Donovan's working with Franco Zeffirelli. Johnny Winter and his band have been thrown out of the Mayfair Hotel for strange goings on. And somebody's been to the 100 Club and seen Brewers Droop and says they have to be seen to be believed. Weirdly, I've seen Brewers Droop. I saw them that year at the Reading Festival. Did you? Amazing. Wonderful headlines that are just so brilliant. The ELO tour headline is Electric Light Switch On, which is very much in that kind of Bay City Bonkers and Wings Metal Fatigue melody maker tradition. There's news that Aqualung by Jethro Tull is out, and it's going to be a punch in the face for the church. And people will undoubtedly be offended by it because it's anti-religious. This is their manager, Terry Ellis, talking, which is a brilliant piece of marketing, actually. It's a really good way of drumming up publicity and getting them on the front page. Jeffrey Hammond has just got joined the group, who, if you remember right, it was called Jeffrey Hammond, but Ian Anderson didn't think that was, that was aristocratic enough, so asked him to change his name to Jeffrey Hammond. Just super. But no, the key thing in it is John Peel, of course, writes a column. Do you remember John Peel? He said he did one in Sounds later on. Now, he was really funny, John Peel. He was so funny. And he talks about being at home with the pig. I used to think that was just, it was just a fantasy for me. It was just so, he was so cool, you know. And he said a foam-flecked runner appeared at our door, by which I mean somebody just rang the doorbell. I think it's a foam-flecked runner. It tells them a group called Stack Waddy is on at a pub nearby, and you ought to go and see it.
Stack
he describes
Waddy.
This as Stack Waddy, a band he describes as being loud, demoralising, vulgar, and crude. He says the wretched Stack Waddy.
Can I interrupt with a point of information on Stack Waddy?
Yeah,
I think I'm correct in saying that their album was called Bugger Off.
It was called Bugger Off. Absolutely correct. I've got a feeling that Peel actually put them out on the Dandelion label, but I may be wrong.
He might have done. Sorry, carry on.
But he said the wretched Stack Waddy have an LP available with which you can intimidate and depress your friends and ruin parties. He says, far from being a setback, this is nothing more than an endorsement of their policies and the ultimate accolade. It's absolutely brilliant.
It's that rising note at the end.
The ultimate accolade, you know. And then he talks about a group called Fanny. Do you remember an American group called Fanny who just appeared?
Because
people were all excited about them. And he said that he thinks they might be playing at the speakeasy. He said, I shall wear my football shorts. He said, and drive them mad with desire as I lean, pouting, and to all outward appearances, brainless, against the bar, a vision of sheer loveliness. I think that's just wonderful. But it's just... Peel's sort of self-interest was absolutely sensational, wasn't it? They were nearly all about him fancying and chasing after women and how women should be fancying him.
I was amazed looking...
As I think I once told you, when I was at a festival, in what's it called? The Lincoln Festival, the Great Bardney Festival. And Peel was the DJ, and I can remember him on stage saying... He said, I slept alone last night, campers. And if any of you young ladies would like to avail yourselves of my lithe and athletic body, please report backstage to my caravan at 6 o'clock. I can remember thinking, that is unbelievable. But hey, hashtag different times.
So that's disc, what is it? Disc and Music Echo. It disappeared, didn't it? Yeah, it just got absorbed into something else. All these things, they all get absorbed, don't they? The enemy absorbed accordion times. You know,
that's right.
You can still write to the enemy, if the enemy still exists, and say, I feel that your accordion coverage has rather slipped in the last 40 years. But because the beauty of old music papers is always just looking at the small ads, you know. This issue has even got a small ad for a hotel, the Stonehall House Hotel, 20 minutes from the West End. Presumably they're offering this as a potential place for kind of bands to stay. First class room and breakfast hotels. Terms from £1.375 daily. That they translate that into pre-decimal, into it's 27 and 6. There's nothing like old music papers.
God, there's none of that in Disc and Music Echo. All we've got is an ad for the Modern Mail new mini brief, which is kind of like Y fronts basically. That's pretty much the only small ad. The rest is people trying to join bands, you know. But it tells you so much about the times, doesn't it? And the other weird thing is an interview with Michael Parkinson. What about that? Michael Parkinson, what he's doing in Disc and Music Echo, I don't know. But the journalist goes on about how this girl says how fantastically good looking he is and how Michael Parkinson endorses the idea of growing long hair. He said parents are wrong to admonish their children for having long hair. So what a hipster he turned out to be.
Here's a trivia question for you. How many of the people on the cover of Band on the Run are still with us?
Oh, my Lord. Okay, who was there? It was Kenny Lynch was one of them. I think he's still with
Kenny
us.
Kenny Lynch died a few weeks ago.
Parkinson's still with us.
Parkinson's still with us. Paul McCartney, obviously.
Not Pete Cushing. There's Paul McCartney and Linda
Christopher
McCartney.
Christopher Lee is no longer with
Lane.
Us.
Denny Lane? I don't know if Denny Lane
no,
is still
No, I don't think
us.
He is. I think John Conte, maybe.
John Conte.
So I think...
Christopher Lee, and the other one was Clement Freud, wasn't it? Was that,
no longer
who
with
is
us.
Not with us?
No.
God, how extraordinary.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So, interesting pop facts. And they're interesting because they interest me.
Well, they interest us.
Possibly you. they interest us. And I was thinking about Pink Floyd, and I was thinking back to in the 1970s. I can remember a conversation having about this in a cafe with Jake Rivera, actually, in 1977, just about how much money Pink Floyd had. You know, that they were regarded, particularly for those in kind of punk rock, pub rock, you know, that kind of emergent class. Pink Floyd were regarded as having more money than God, yes? Because they'd sold so many copies of Dark Side of the Moon in 1973. They just carried on selling and selling and selling. And it was the first record I recall where the scale of its sales success was almost part of its story, wasn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was.
It's part of its myth. Just this sheer scale. It kept on trundling away. They must have more money than they know what to do with. Of course, that wasn't necessarily true, because as I think the notorious B.I.G. pointed out many years later, mo money, mo problems, yes? And Pink Floyd had made a lot of money at The Dark Side of the Moon, and they decided to invest it, yes, to minimise tax demand and so forth, you know, because spread it over a period of time. So the money they started to make in 1973, 74 didn't come in until 77, 78, because that's the way those things work. And they invested it, decided to invest it with this company called Norton Warburg, who were subsequently found to have been in more trouble than they appeared on the outside, and were taking money out of the client's accounts in order to keep their own operation going. And so Pink Floyd went from appearing to have more money than they knew what to do with to suddenly facing an absolute crisis, that the money was going to run out and the government were going to come looking for their tax and there wouldn't be anything to pay it with.
And so, they had significant records to finish and get out against the schedule, didn't they?
Well, the issue was the wall. That's why they did the wall overseas, because the accountants have worked out you've got to spend a year out of the country, because, and then you put off your tax liability for another year. And you've got to go and make a record that, tell you what, guys, no use just doing what you feel like. This has got to be a big hit record, yes?
This has got to make some absolutely stonking piles of cash.
Yeah, so they start making the wall, and they get in Bob Ezrin as the producer. Bob Ezrin, somewhat unlikely figure, best known for his success with Alice Cooper. And Bob Ezrin is the person who spots another brick in the wall, which was only a fragment, only a verse and one chorus or something, and says, that's a hit record. And they all said, nah, don't be silly. He said, no, that's a hit record. He keeps on working on this. And this is the late 70s. And he says to Dave Gilmour, do you know what? If you want a success, you've got to go to these places called discos and you've got to listen to the music that's being played. And so Dave Gilmour goes and does this thing. Doesn't particularly enjoy it, but comes back. And Bob Ezrin says, we're going to do this and it's going to be 100 beats per minute. Because 100 beats per minute is Dancing Queen, it's I Will
sells.
Survive.
Yeah.
It's absolutely what sells. And so that's what they did. They developed it and they put on it one element which Bob Ezrin had previously had great success with. What is that element, Mark? It is children's voices. Children's voice?
Yeah, it's the choir.
Because he'd done it with Schools Out. He'd done it with Schools Out. Alice Cooper, which finished with no more homework, no more, you know, no more teacher's dirty looks, all that stuff. And so once they talked about bringing kids' chorus on it, he was all in favour of this because he says, this works. This is always really commercial. And it was, of course, the Christmas number one record. And, you know, it fitted into Christmas, even though the incredibly depressing song about, you know, education and the
absolutely
kind of poisoning of young minds and so forth. But it's got, you know, it's got kids' chorus on it. And what's number one the following year? There's no one quite like Grandma, you know, the St. Winifred School Choir.
And in a change in the copyright law in 1997, some of the former members of that choir sued, didn't they, for unpaid royalties because they were never paid and lost
probably
the case. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Probably, yes, because, well, you know, classically, where there's a hit, there's a writ, you know. But
yeah.
And I couldn't believe it. It was, I went and looked at this, that when it went, that went to number one, it was number one for 5 weeks, I think, over the Christmas in 1979-80. And they hadn't had a chart record for the whole of the 70s. Their last chart record was, I think, See Emily Play or Arnold Lane, whichever was the second of their two early singles. So singles were released from Dark Side of the Moon and Animals and all those things. Not hits at all. Didn't trouble the charts until this came along And suddenly, you know, it's huge. And it completely kick-starts their career all over again.
All over again.
You know? But they did this, you know, with bankruptcy staring them in the face. It's an absolutely amazing
tale. It's an extraordinary story. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, how these things just, you know, you've got to deal with the business, you know, somehow.
There was such a dramatic story.
You can't get away from it.
Pink Floyd's such a dramatic story. The thing that struck me recently was that they were incredibly vicious. In the mid-60s, the general policy was, you know, and the Beatles are a really good example. Every one of the Beatles albums, apart from the White Album, had the Beatles on the cover. The policy was try and develop a relationship between the audience and the individual members of the band. And the Pink Floyd, very bravely, did precisely the opposite, didn't they? Piper at the Gates of Dawn had a picture of the Pink Floyd on it. And after that, they said, we don't want to, apart from Mama Gummer, they said, we don't want to appear on the cover of any of our albums. You know, the collective for the Pink Floyd was the important thing, not the individual. The best seat at a Pink Floyd concert was at the back, which was just something that was only ever being pioneered before by the Grateful Dead. And it's true. I remember going to see the Pink Floyd in the early 70s, and you wanted to be at the back. You wanted to see the fireworks. You wanted to see the spectacle. You wanted to see the aeroplane lumbering down the line. You wanted to see the, you know what I mean, the movies and all that. And the actual individual members of the Pink Floyd weren't that important. And I think it's really interesting. And The Wall, of course, you know, they had those other musicians, Snowy White playing the part of David Gilmour. The point being, it doesn't really matter who it is. It's not the individual members that are important. And this all backfired when Roger Waters left the group in great acrimony. And went off on his own because he thought, and you can understand this to some extent, he thought that because he wrote all the songs, he was the heart and soul of the Pink Floyd. And he was going to take all the following with him. And I interviewed him once and he told me this really poignant story about playing in Cincinnati in 1987 on his Radio Chaos tour. It was really honest of him to say. He said, I was playing a 6,000-seat venue that was only half full. There were 3,000 people in there. And he said, across the road was the Enormodome. Which was packed, an 80,000-seater venue where the Pink Floyd were playing. And I really felt some sympathy for him because the great irony was, of course, was there was nothing really to do with those songs. It was to do this. The point about the Floyd was the spectacle and it was the sound. And the sound of the Floyd is largely David Gilmour's voice and David Gilmour's guitar. And, you know, and Roger Waters just came, you know, had not foreseen what kind of a disaster might lie ahead for him, you know. I mean, clearly he has some money in the bank, but it didn't work out the way he wanted.
But it also goes to prove, you know, the thing that you and I have often said, and Pink Floyd surely are a classic case of this, that the most valuable asset of any band is the name.
Is the name, completely.
But particularly the name Pink Floyd, because it somehow, even from the early days, to my mind, it kind of evoked a certain sort of music, a certain sort of ethereal, chemical, dreamy, psychedelic.
We always thought it was a type of acid. We thought it was like kind of window pane, or, you know, we thought it was some type of acid. We thought it was a drug thing, but it wasn't at all, was it? It was a mixture of the two.
The thing that's gone down in history is that Sid Barrett was a fan of the two blues men, Pink Anderson and Floyd Council. It's not actually true. The story, as far as I can ascertain, is that he and a mate had a Blind Boy Fuller album in 1964, which was put out kind of on Philips sort of jazz series.
Yeah.
And in the sleeve notes of this record, just introducing Blind Boy Fuller, is a bit of background about talking about all the singers, you know, the itinerant blues musicians who kind of lost to, you know, there were no recordings or whatever, or they just disappeared. And he says, I'm reading it here, I've got it in front of me, Curly Weaver and Fred McMullen, Georgia born, but more frequently to be found in Kentucky or Tennessee. Pink Anderson or Floyd Council. These were a few amongst the many blues singers that were to be heard in the rolling hills of the Piedmont or meandering with the streams through the wooded valleys. Of this considerable body of folk talent, anonymous and legendary alike, none was more famous than Blind Boy Fuller. And the record was a Blind Boy Fuller record. And it's just that the mate saw those two names together, Pink Anderson and Floyd Council, in the same line and thought, Pink Floyd. The Pink Floyd. I think it was the Pink Floyd sound, wasn't it, first of all?
Pink Floyd.
And then, they just dropped it. And these two guys, you know, died in kind of obscurity, probably never knowing, you know, that just by an accident of sleeve design and those two names just being next to each other, that this, you know, that they lent their name unconsciously to this extraordinary
thing. And what a fabulous
thing.
Name. See, this
it's
is
fantastic.
They started off as the Megadeths, didn't they? And then they were Leonard's Lodgers, because that was the name of their landlord. And then the Spectrum 5. These are very hip middle 60s names, actually. The Screaming Abdabs, the Architectural Abdabs, Sigma 6, the T-Set. I think they were called the T-Set. Or one of them was a member of the T-Set, anyway. And then the Pink Floyd sound. You're right. And what a brilliant...
But you can't. But once it's established as Pink Floyd, you can't imagine any of those other names doing at all, can you? You know, it's the
no,
Pink
you can't.
Floyd.
You can't.
It somehow... Did it always sound quite grand? I think it probably always did. You know, it was one of those names I remember when I was 16, 17. You felt good saying it.
You did.
To people. Have you heard the Pink Floyd? And then it very quickly
epic.
Became the Floyd, you know.
The Floyd.
It sounded epic, you know, and it just fitted in with those kind of names, you know, particularly at the time there was a habit of putting colours before things, wasn't it? It was like the blue meanies and, you know.
Yeah.
White bicycle and, you know.
Just having colours and names. And deep purple.
There seemed something psychedelic about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it proved to be bigger than all of them, didn't it? You know, and... they're not together anymore, are they, Mark? But they somehow seem
Floyd,
as if they are.
They God, they fell out, didn't they? My goodness, astonishing. And to see them at Live Aid, it was rather extraordinary, really, that they did actually manage to get over it all and get back together for that one event, and despite unbelievable animosity. But what?
Because they've all pretty much all been fired at one time or another, haven't they? Or been threatened to be fired.
Well, Rick Wright was fired, wasn't he, in the late 70s, I think.
During the sessions for The Wall.
And as Rick Wright, you and I have talked about this before, very underrated part of the group. I mean, just, you know, as Peter Jenner famously said, you know, he felt that Roger Waters had a problem with Rick Wright because he was better looking and had a better voice. And also contributed that amazing textural sound, those keyboard sounds, which is so important as a part of it.
The Word Podcast, walking the digital dog since 2007.
A bit of a PS, which I thought we should mention, the great Terry Doran. Terry Doran, there's a picture of him in the Times this morning. He died the other day. He died on the 18th of April, actually. And what an interesting character. There's so many extraordinary characters in the kind of extended family of the Beatles. And he's one of them. He was the guy who was always known as the man from the motor trade, actually. The guy who supplied the wheels, as they put it, for the Beatles. And you forget that the Beatles became they were obsessed with cars, weren't they? All of them just had this massive appetite for buying. Lennon had a Ferrari and a Lamborghini and a stretch Mercedes and a Rolls Royce Phantom 5. And McCartney had an Aston Martin with a tape recorder installed in it, especially. And
so he was
George
the guy
Harrison.
Who always supplied them, was it?
Yeah,
so
he supplied
nicely
the cars.
A living out of just. So I'm the man who gets the cars from the Beatles.
I know. And
my
he just got on
God.
Really well with them, and they loved him. He was really funny. Liverpudlian and fantastic. He was a fantastically funny guy. Really got on with John Lennon. When John Lennon married and got together with Yoko Ono, he kind of. That relationship didn't kind of sustain. And I guess probably Yoko Ono might not have taken to him. Another kind of scouse, lippy scouse geezer. And he then became the estate manager at Friar Park. And he ran, you know, he ran George Harrison's house with his 120-room Gothic mansion in Henley. And he also wrote one word. This is brilliant. He wrote one word in a Beatles song. And John was writing Day in the Life. And he said, I got to the point where what did the holes do in the Albert Hall? You got the idea of holes. He got the idea of Albert Hall. And Terry Doran said, they fill the Albert Hall. And so, you know, great credit to him. He actually wrote one word in a lyric by the Beatles, which is good work, isn't it?
It's more than
but
you
I can remember done. George Martin. I remember interviewing George Martin. He was talking about how fascinating it was that the Beatles just loved these kind of material things, you know, particularly George Harrison. Because, of course, George Harrison, there he was with his profound Indian religious beliefs. And George Martin had an operation once an ear operation, was recuperating at home. And George Harrison turned up to give him a little tiny Indian deity, a little tiny statue of a kind of Shiva or something to put by his bedside to emanate good vibes, to make you feel a little bit better, you know. And he said, George Martin, they looked out the window and there parked in the drive outside was a kind of crimson Lamborghini or whatever it was, you know. And he thought this was such a brilliant combination of two kind of people wrapped up in one man, the same guy who kind of has this kind of Eastern religious belief and talks about spirituality, still has a kind of, you know, £150,000 car. Wonderful.
They're all like that, aren't they?
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.